But as we mature in this, you got right. Sorry? Yeah, it's nice and clean. You can actually write something else. Right, so lots of pages. I have a quiz about very few of you.
Yeah.
I have a quiz about Jane, but I have a lot of notes, so I will post that on the internet for you to play with if you want to. I encourage you to participate in Didact's game of collecting magic words, because obviously if you give the definitions, and it also means that you will have the word, as it were. But anyway, that's another question. Okay. What would you say is the genre of Jane Eyre?
Melodrama?
Well, that's a good start. Okay. Right. There is a surprising mixture of genres, which is why you found it so difficult to answer the question, and that's what we're going to start by looking at. There are clearly autobiographical elements. We can assume that the story roughly coincides with Charlotte's life up to the point of writing it, obviously not afterwards. She was born in 1816, and she published the book in 1847. And that, given the time frame that we're given, the book starts when she's about 10 and finishes when she's about 30, with most of the action happening around when she is about 1920, that coincides very much with her age in those different moments. I've seen people arguing in different places like the internet, that the novel is meant to be set in the first decade of the 19th century. But as far as I know, there's no reference at all to war with France, and so that doesn't make very much sense to me. I think it's really basically about her time scale of life. If you can think of any evidence to contradict me, I would love to know it, but I can't think of anything. Anyway, Charlotte's mother died, who was called Maria. Normally when we want to say Maria, we mispronounce it as Mariah in English, who was called Maria Bronte, died of cancer in 1821, and of course we know that Jane, aged 10, is an orphan, so there are possibly biographical elements there. By 1825, Maria Jr., Charlotte's sister, Elizabeth, Charlotte, and Emily were all at Cowbridge School, and as you know, in that year the two elder sisters died of tuberculosis. Otherwise of saying tuberculosis? If we don't want to say tuberculosis, how else can we say tuberculosis? Synonyms for tuberculosis? No? Consumption, yes. Consumption occasionally, very occasionally, can refer to pneumonia as well. It usually refers to tuberculosis. The normal British English, the normal English, I don't think it's the same in America, way of referring to tuberculosis is TB, because it's too long, basically. And as a result of those deaths and other deaths, there was an inspection, and the conditions at the school were found to be insalubrious, and so the two surviving daughters were taken away to be homeschooled. Obviously, Helen Burns has elements of Mariah and Elizabeth, a sort of composite figure taken from that. Cowan Bridge, like Lowood, seems to have been a place designed to inculcate a sense of humility and inferiority, not to educate. In 1831, Charlotte went to Miss Wooler's Row Head School in Murfield, wherever Murfield is. I should know this area. I went to university in Yorkshire, but I'm not sure where that village is. It's somewhere down there. Some of the more positive aspects of Lowood, especially Miss Temple, probably come from Miss Wooler's school and that period in Jane's life. In 1835, Charlotte became an assistant teacher at Miss Wooler's school. So the process of going from student to assistant teacher is the same in the real case and in the novel. In 1839, Charlotte visited Norton Conyers, which is meant to be the model for Thornfield Hall. It's a big country house in the area. That's near Ripon, which is just south of York. While in the same year, she turned down two proposals of marriage from different clergymen. And so probably elements of the St. John episode are taken from that. Notice we pronounce St. John St. John. Okay, that's how you pronounce it, I'm afraid. Yeah, sorry. It's just one of those silly English names. In 1841, Charlotte worked as a governess in a home near Bradford, and of course she was working as a governess at Thornfield, so there are parallels there. The most complicated, but perhaps in some sense the most important part of the nexus between novel and life comes in 1843 when Charlotte was in Brussels to study French at the school owned by Madame Hegier, and she is known to have basically fallen in love with Constantine Hegier, with the father of the family. There is absolutely no evidence that there was any sex or anything, but she had an infatuation with him. And Charlotte's biographer, Claire Harmon, sees echoes of the Byronic Constantine Hegier behind Jane's demanding, volatile, cigar-smoking, married employer, Mr. Rochester. The likeness between Charlotte's fictional hero and Monsignor Hegier is marked. Under his moodiness, born of secret woes, Rochester is a man of fine sensibility and affection. Hegier was somebody who had actively participated in the revolution of 1830, when Belgium became separate from whatever it was part of, I don't know. Places back or something. Yeah. I think it was his brother-in-law died in the revolution, etc., etc. So there's a sort of dark past there that's this happening. And the next year, in 1844, Charlotte returned home to care for her father, who was almost blind. And so there may be elements of more or less blind Rochester at the end of the novel there. In the 1840s, people go away. In the 1840s, Charlotte and her sisters tried to start a village school, very much like Mary Wollstonecraft and her sisters in Fanny Blood. But they couldn't find enough pupils, and of course, the time when Jane is working in the village school for I think is the right word. Syndrome is related to that. So obviously, this is not just a thinly disguised autobiography, but Charlotte does draw a lot on her own experience, which is probably a good thing. There are also elements of spiritual autobiography in this novel. Jane is on a quest to discover her own identity. The novel can be seen as a feminized reworking of the traditional quest story in which the hero encounters a series of dangers, obstacles, and monsters in the search for his goal. So instead of having a knight in shining armor charging around the countryside on a horse, you have a feminized version of this with her having to get over a series of problems. This is influenced by Pilgrim's Progress in the novel's exploration of religiosity. Bunyan's book Christianized the quest where Bronte's feminized it. So it's a similar idea of reworking earlier fictional forms. The novels of Charlotte and Emily Bronte treat the passions of women as uncharted territory. To express feeling is a right women have been denied until that time. So, religion is important in this novel. Without the novel being tendentious and trying to sell or promote or proselytize for a particular religious slant, as it were. Jane encounters three main religious figures in the novel. St. John, the last.
What's the name of the...
Mr. Brocklehurst, good one. And the last one?
Helen
Burns, good. So, Jane encounters three main religious figures in the novel. Each represents a model of religion that Jane ultimately rejects as she forms her own ideas about faith and principle and their practical consequences. St. John is admirable in his public face, but too cold in his domestic self. Jane describes him as a cold, cumbrous column, which alliterates, of ice-cold white marble. You understand marble?
Yeah.
So he's comparable in that sense to Mr. Brocklehurst, who is a black pillar. You have white marble, column of white marble, black pillar, in terms of idea in black and white. And the Dowager Lady Ingram is also compared to a marble column. So these figures who are seen as columns of stone are unflexible. They're not something that can be adapted for Jane for her own life. Jane admires Helen Burns, but her passivity and her death willingness are not for Jane. Jane just does not see the world in that way. Rivers, to some extent, can be seen as a grown-up, as an adult version of Helen. But also expresses Christian stoicism and is death willing. He's perfectly happy to go and die as a missionary, the sort of thing you could imagine perfectly easily Helen doing in her way. Where Rochester is too passionate in volume two, Rivers is too rational and passionless. Rivers rightly recognizes that Miss Oliver wouldn't stand the life of a missionary's wife, but fails to see that Jane wouldn't stand being his wife. Jane strong enough to be a missionary's wife, but not his wife. Jane needs emotional as well as spiritual sustenance. Catholicism is attacked in the fact that someone as cold and heartless as Eliza Reed, representing empty ritual, can become a nun and rise to Mother Superior. She is obviously somebody who has no charity, no passion. Jane, of course, hit myself with that. Charlotte, of course, had come across Catholicism above all in Belgium, in Brussels. Not a lot of Catholics in the village of Haworth, but that's where she had encountered Catholicism. In the end, Jane learns to form her relationship with God on her own terms, not according to the dictates of others. So a sort of do-it-yourself religion. Another genre which has an important impact on Jane Eyre is the genre of fairy tale. The structure of the novel can be very much compared to Cinderella, or, it's topical because there's a new version, Beauty and the Beast. There is also the fairy tale of Bluebeard. Do you know the story of Bluebeard? Bluebeard was, I believe, a pirate. Most people called Beard are pirates. He married Mrs. Bluebeard, and they lived happily in a house, but she was told that she could do what she liked in the house, go to every room except for one, which was kept locked. One day he went away on business, and she found the key and unlocked the door and found the bodies of all of the previous wives in the spare room. Jane describes the passageway at Thornhill Hall as reminding her of a corridor in some Bluebeard's castle. So the reference seems to be explicit in that sense. Also, in the description of Mr. Brocklehurst's face, the novel says, "What a face he had, what a big nose, what a mouth, what large prominent teeth." What does that remind you of? Yes, good. The big... Sorry? Little Red Hood, right. And the big wolf. But one of the things about English is that we often add extra words in order to create figures of sound, which, as you know, is my obsession. Right. So, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Now, there is no such thing as a Riding Hood anywhere in English, any reference to a Riding Hood, apart from in the reference to Little Red Riding Hood. In the novel, we are never told that she goes riding. But we add the riding so that we have consonants with red. And the same thing happens with the wolf. You say, the big wolf. Why not? But it's the big bad wolf. Then we have to add the bad as opposed to a good, nice, cuddly wolf. Have you ever encountered wolves?
Yeah.
There's some friends of mine have a nature reserve near to the Escorial. And I was allowed to go in with the female wolves. Apparently the male wolves are too dangerous to have people they don't know going in with them. But the female wolves are kept in one enclosure. And I was allowed to go in. And it was fascinating because the head female wolf came up to me and I started stroking her. And she turned over onto her stomach so that I could stroke her stomach, etc. But then one of the other female wolves came close, and the female who was here in an instant got up and attacked the other wolf to go away, and then came back to restrain some more. It was sort of a moment. I didn't really feel threatened in myself, but suddenly you went from saying, "This is just a dog," Let's face it, this is a wild animal. The level of instant aggression that the wolf was capable of is incredible. A beautiful animal, really, really beautiful animal. Anyway, so yes, the big bad wolf. When Rochester first appears to Jane, she describes his dog and horse as Guytrashes, the pronunciation. A northern dialect word for ghosts and apparitions encountered on lonely roads. And this term is taken from the fairy tales that Bessie told Jane. So there's a relationship there. He later tells her that during this incident, he thought that she was a fairy. So we have this situation where both of them are seeing each other as supernatural beings in this situation. And of course, she has already identified herself as a fairy she has already identified herself as a fairy in the Red Room. Yeah, you see? Like a supernatural being, Jane seems to have prophetic dreams. Rochester dresses as a gypsy in a red cloak, possibly Little Red Riding Hood again, and in this role he gives Mason a magic potion, Sleeping Beauty perhaps. Jane's arrival at Ferndean is an inversion of the fairy tale trope of the prince cutting his way through the forest to find Sleeping Beauty. And Bessie's ballad of a poor orphan child wandering alone on the moors in chapter 3 is foreshadows Jane's own experience in chapter 28. So there's a lot of fairy tale in there. But the novel is also heavily influenced by the Romantics. Berwick's History of British Birds, the book which he hits John Reed with, is full of sublime images of shipwrecks and storms and Arctic wastes, high mountains and death and disaster, typical images of romanticism. Rochester is clearly a Byronic figure, brooding, apparently misanthropist, forceful, charismatic, and independent. By the way, Heathcliff in Wuthering Heights, which is pronounced Wuthering Heights, not Wuthering or anything like that, Wuthering Heights, is another Byronic figure. However, Charlotte undermines the Byronic archetype from the very beginning. He appears as this dark, majestic figure on his black horse and immediately falls off, okay, and is injured. That's not very Byronic in itself. In the end, Jane transforms him into a mild-mannered husband, dependent on his wife for moral and intellectual guidance. In fact, Jane is ultimately the true Byronic hero of the novel. Finally, it is Jane, not Rochester or St. John, who achieves the philosophical ideal embodied in that figure. In her passage through loneliness, isolation, intense suffering, and temptation, Jane asserts her own identity, hugely important for a Byronic figure, asserts her own individuality, forges a sense of identity, and proclaims her freedom and independence of will. The central theme of Jane Eyre is essentially the romantic conceit of the self as individual and unique. In volume 2, chapter 8, there is an allusion to Keats's poem Ode to a Nightingale, which you may have heard of. And there are also references to A Midsummer Night's Dream, which, although it is by Shakespeare, had quite a lot of influence on the Romantics. In volume 3, chapter 2, Jane recognizes God's omnipotence and omnipresence on the moor at night. This is reminiscent of the romantic idea of the romantic idea that nature can teach morality, as in Wordsworth's Prelude. But Jane Eyre also is significantly influenced by the genre of Gothic literature. The first half of the novel is dominated by Gothic references to a nursemaid who teaches her charge about folklore and the supernatural, witches, fairies, sprites, incubi, imps, ghosts, vampires, eerie laughs, gypsy fortune tellers, and mad women, all of which are typical of Gothic literature. Gothic fantasies typically begin with an ingenue arriving at an old, gloomy mansion. So you have an innocent young woman arriving at Dracula's castle or whatever type of thing. In moments of anxiety, Jane's mind sees the face of Judas morphing, changing into that of Satan in the panels on the door of the old cabinet in her room. The intense sexual magnetism that Rochester exerts over Jane is barely understood by the young woman. She is in turmoil due to the struggle between intense passion and the belief that such passion cannot go unpunished. As I mentioned, in Gothic literature, there tends to be quite a lot of sexuality, to some extent sublimized or hidden or metaphorically speaking, there are quite a lot of sexuality within Gothic literature. Dracula is all about sex, for example. Although, in any other course, do you get to study Dracula? No, I don't think you do. It's a shame. It's very interesting as literature, and where it all comes from. That's another question. Right. In the game of charades, how do you say charades? Charades. I think charades is... charades. But it's not charades. Is it charades? Charades. Is it charades? Well, in charades, in charades, in the game of charades. Yeah, we sort of pronounce it in a sort of French way, more or less. The word bride is followed by the word well. Now, a bride well is a type of prison for minor crimes, for like moral crimes and things like that. So that's all very wordplay. Bronte was clearly influenced by Anne Radcliffe, our old friend Anne Radcliffe. For instance, in A Sicilian Romance, the strange occurrences that terrify the sisters are the result of their mother having been imprisoned by her father, who declared her dead in order to marry again. So the mother's locked up in a tower in the corner of the big mansion they live in. So they see lights and movement at night in the corner of this town, and it's originally looks like it seems to be a ghost, etc. And they finally end up work out that it's their mother, which of course is all very, very reminiscent of Bertha Mason. Moreover, as with all of Radcliffe's romances, most, if not all, of what seems supernatural in Jane Eyre has a logical or a psychological explanation. Okay, we're not left with magic really exists necessarily. psychological distortions of things exist, madness exists, but magic and superstition in them, or magic in itself doesn't really. Robert Heilmann has suggested that Bronte revised the Gothic mode using its conventions and motives to symbolize the enigmatic parts of the human personality and the unconscious self, if you like. So we have that. I need to have some tea.
And I really should accept the fact I need to wear glasses. Tea and glasses.
And the name, the ear,
oh, we've had a long conversation about names, about abstinence. Don't worry. Well, that's coming very soon. Not really. And to some extent, you could argue that the nearest thing you come is something like Don Juan, or maybe, or probably a better example would be Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, which of course is poetry. Because still at that stage, and remember we're talking maybe or at least a good generation earlier than this, the novel is still an inferior form. It's almost that sort of situation. As I tried to express, it's very much about perception rather than reality. For me, and I mean, for most people, as I try it, being objective, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner is a masterpiece. I'm not criticizing it at all, but it is fundamentally Gothic. The thing is that Gothic has an element of criticism, and novel has an element of criticism until we get to the, until really after people have fully realized how good Jane Austen was. Jane Austen is really the person who turns novels into, the major art form of the Victorian age. Even though Charlotte Bronte was very nasty about Jane Austen. Charlotte Bronte said that she wasn't really a novelist. She just described social surroundings. But anyway, and of course, really, the, literature for the Victorians means novels. It doesn't mean poetry. Yes, you have the great Victorian poets of Browning and Tennyson. For me, Jeremiah Hopkins is a greater Victorian poet, but nobody knew he existed until the 1920s. He was rediscovered in the 1920s. So he doesn't really count in terms of the Victorians' perception of things, whereas the Victorians had the idea that they were exporting Dickens and Elizabeth Gaskell and George Eliot and Meredith and all of the other people and Trollope to the world. And these people were as highly considered as the Russian writers at the same time. I think the Russian writers are probably better writers. But anyway, they were where Victorian literature really took off and had a huge influence on the world was in the novel, and so the Victorians start to value it. But it's that's the problem, really. You have people like Wordsworth don't want to be associated with the Gothic because they are great poets, and a great poet can't be associated with the Gothic. So not really, but of course, but what I'm saying is there is a huge overlap, obviously. Again, Frankenstein is something which comes out of a romantic milieu that is a Gothic novel, to some extent. It's probably better described as a piece of science fiction, as the first piece of science fiction. But it has a huge influence of Gothic novels. So it's a problem. But it's a problem because of snobbery about definitions, rather than the fact that of the factor of influence. I mean, and again, the sort of painting that will, you have the same type of thing in the world of visual art. You will have Fuseli, Henri Fuseli, and John Martin described as probably more described as Gothic painters, whereas Turner and Constable are Romantic painters. Now, there are moments when the sort of subject matter that's being painted, like when if Turner does a painting of Hannibal crossing the Alps, it's incredibly similar to the same type of subject matter by John Martin. It's infinitely better because it's Turner. But the paintings look, on a very superficial level, incredibly similar. But one would tend to be considered slightly more Gothic just because that's a slightly more insulting word. More or less. Okay. Another genre which is enormously important in this case is Bildungsroman. Dana has much in common with the coming of age novels of the Victorian period, like David Copperfield or Mill on the Floss. Jane presents a society in which a young woman's secure place depends on looks, wealth, and family. And initially she has none of those, and to some extent, by the end of the novel, she has all of them. Remember that Jane has been educated for the benefit of others. She can be a governess or a school teacher. That's sort of the options here. It's a little bit like being British in Spain. You can be a translator or an English teacher. She excels in her book learning and conforms to the religion of her education, but neither has a huge impact on her inner life, which is largely ruled by superstition. The religious teaching she has received doesn't relate much to her life, so her own psychological references are to a much more naturalistic God. Jane is on a quest, and her quest is to find out who Jane Eyre is. She frequently does not recognize herself, starting with her reflection in the mirror in the Red Room. Ah, there it is. Right, I can now see the text. This is exciting. I can't see you, but I can see the text. So you win some, you lose some. She has to remind herself of her identity, such as in the self-portrait of a governess, disconnected, poor, and plain. Jane's artistic self and her true self are closely linked, as the title of this drawing suggests. Jane frequently tells her story to the apothecary, Mr. Lloyd, which is pronounced Lloyd, not Lloyd, by the way, to Helen Burns, to Miss Temple, to Rochester, and to St. John. Telling her story becomes synonymous with knowing herself and establishing her identity. And of course, as she tells her story, the thing develops and it changes according to her age. So there's quite a lot of realism with a small r in the fact that early on in the story, a lot of her references are more to things related to fairy tales, etc. This sort of thing will be picked up on by James Joyce. When you read Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, the early parts of the book are written as if they were written by a five-year-old, and then they develop up according to the age, etc. But that sort of fun you will see next year. Right. So those are the main genres which come to play in the novel. Another aspect which is interesting but is not related to a genre is Jane's process is guided by a series of substitute mothers. Bessie, who offers consolation and a sensitivity to the supernatural, this temple, who offers consolation and teaches self-control, Mrs. Fairfax, who teaches a sense of status as well as nurture, and Diana Reed, who teaches Jane to be independent and self-assertive. Jane also has supernatural mothers. There is the white vision in human form in chapter 27 she sees on the night of her parting from Rochester and calls Mother, and the universal Mother Nature mentioned in chapter 28 when she is lost on the moor. Jane is on a quest to find love, but she insists on being loved without self-abnegation. She has spent too long finding herself to deny herself for someone else. Jane also has a series of surrogate and supernatural children before having her own children. There's the doll at Gateshead, Adele, the tiny infant she carries in her dream, representing her orphan self that she must nurture and bring to maturity, and the young child in the dream about the ruin of a Thornfield that prevents her from leaving Rochester. Bertha Mason, of course, is a sort of doppelganger for Jane Eyre, and she is the catalyst for the growth of Jane's self-understanding. Jane goes through a process of learning when to speak, when to express herself, and when to be silent. This is self-control, but it is also controlling how she interacts with others, controlling the image of herself she projects to others. Jane must also learn a path of moderation between moral duty and earthly pleasure, her spiritual and her physical needs. By the end of the novel, Jane has become a mature woman who knows her own mind and can resist convention. There is also a level of satire in the novel. Above all, the depiction of charitable institutions like Lowood, which has very little charitable about it, and of upper-class society that is rigid and lacking in human feeling, especially as represented by the Ingrams. So the novel can be seen as a satire on institutionalized religion and high society. Charlotte Bronte dedicated Jane Eyre to William Thackeray, who's the satirist who had written at that time, a few months before, Vanity Fair. And she considered him the first social regenerator of the day, the first in the sense of the most important social regenerator of the day, believing that his satire could help to correct the warped system of things, the corrupted nature of British society, that there was a moral purpose behind the novel in that sense. The serious purpose of Jane Eyre is to expose the hypocrisy, self-interest and moral bankruptcy of her society and to help to change it. There are also elements of realism in this novel. The realism of the dialogues in Jane Eyre surpasses almost anything that had been written up to that point. Moreover, the psychological realism, as Bronte explores the workings of Jane's mind, was also unsurpassed up to that time. It builds on the introspective religious novels of the 1830s and 1840s, which are now completely forgotten, but were of some importance in the two decades before Jane Eyre was written. However, realism in literature means more than being realistic. Realism implies a straightforward causal sequence, an unproblematic representation of the world. Realist literature does not question itself or refer to its own construction as problematic. Jane Eyre, on the other hand, does give a detailed and concrete picture of Jane's world, but many of the details have a secondary symbolic meaning. Moreover, Jane Eyre is a self-reflexive text. We see Jane struggling to compose her own autobiography, and we are made aware that what we are being offered is a written text that is not and cannot be a full direct representation of the world. It is subjective. Behind Bronte's departure from realism is her conviction that human experience is too complex and profound to be fully understood. So, what symbolism do we have? Take the glass off. The red room, good, yes, that's one symbolic space. The mirror, reflections are always important. And the chestnuts, okay. The two key concepts are fire and ice. Where does Charlotte Bronte get the idea of fire and ice from? The two big concepts are fire versus ice. Where does Charlotte Bronte get this contrast from directly? Frankenstein. I mean, it goes back to Petrarch and whatever, but in a direct sense, in a novel, it comes from Frankenstein. So fire represents passions, anger, and spirit. Rochester's eyes, for example, are described as having fire in them. Jane realizes that as St. John's wife, she would be forced to keep the fire in my nature continually low. So her passions would have to be constantly turned down, as it were. Bertha sets fire to Rochester's bed, foreshadowing the fire that will kill her and emasculate her husband. So the fires are important. Red is associated with fire, passion, and sexuality in Bronte's work. White with coldness and the absence of sexuality. Another way of saying white, en français?
Blanche,
right. Blanche Ingram has this idea of being passionless and a lack of sexuality. Ice represents the oppressive forces trying to extinguish Jane's vitality. Frozen breakfast at Lowood. Okay, well, the frozen breakfast is, of course, a pretty harsh concept as such in realistic terms, but it's also part of that continual, that constant coldness that is part of the environment at that school. And St. John is compared to ice and cold rock. He casts a freezing spell, an encantamiento helado, over Jane. Jane and Rochester meet over ice. Yeah. Later, the fires are lit in Thornfield, when previously the grates had been empty, the fires had been not been lit because Rochester was not home. After forgiving Rochester for his attempted bigamy, Jane resolves that she must be ice and rock to him. Okay, well, again, the guy with controlling passions. Jane will gradually melt and unlearn the icy reserve she acquired at Lowood. Rochester will gradually tame his lascivious passions and learn that relationships should be based on companionship, not just sex, and marriage is about love, not profit. Rochester's disguises in the game of charades as bridegroom, emir, and criminal foreshadow his real-life roles as bridegroom, despotic fiancé, and attempted bigamist. Bertha, Jane's doppelganger, wears and then rips in two her wedding veil, a symbol of lost virginity. During the episode, Jane sees Bertha's face reflected in her own mirror. Hey, mirrors. Lots of mirrors. For you last year, Antonio Andres Ballesteros was the course, the head of department for Grad Women, yes?
Yeah.
He has written the whole book about the importance of mirrors and reflections in Victorian literature. So you could imagine how important these things are. Produced by Castilla-León or Toledo University Press. But anyway, it's interesting. It's an interesting subject. And of course, we've seen mirrors in The Lady of Shalott and Frankenstein and here and all sorts of places. Mirrors are important. Rochester proposes under the great horse chestnut tree. And that night, the tree is split in two by lightning, suggesting supernatural disapproval of the wedding. Dun, dun, dun. Now, the concept of nature here is much more complex and much more interesting than the romantics' idea about nature. In the Lowood chapters, Bronte dismisses the idea that nature feels for humanity in any straightforward way. However, nature can be a symbol of what is true, innocent, and renewable, in contrast to the rottenness, artificiality, and corruption of Thornfield. Both Jane and Rochester are acutely aware of nature and the changing seasons. Both are steeped in the pathetic fallacy. So, one of the things that does not happen here, if you remember, one of our criticisms about Pride and Prejudice is that there was no seasonal grounding. You have a seasonal grounding here. There is an awareness of nature. There is a suggestion, excuse me. There is a suggestion that at some deep, complex, and unknowable level, there is a connection between nature and humanity. But it's complex and problematic, rather like the relationship between nature and humanity in The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Rather like Gerard Manley Hopkins a generation later, to be in tune with nature is to be closer to God. It is to know oneself and to resist the ill effects of modern mechanical society. Brocklehurst sees nature as sinful and seeks to destroy it. We are not to conform to nature, he says. He symbolically has the girl's natural curls cut. That isn't the fact that the hair curls naturally. And of course this goes back to the arguments about nature in things like The Tempest. Whether nature is a good force or a bad force. Bronte believes in the possibility of some profound affinity between humanity and nature. This sentence doesn't make sense, do you know? Means that Jane, Bronte's belief in the possibility of some profound affinity between humanity and nature means that Jane Eyre is ultimately a romantic novel. Coincidence. To what? Most Dickens is ruined for me by the level of coincidence. There's too much confidence for me to believe him. What coincidence do we have here?
I'm here for instance.
So it's a sort of typical small world syndrome, a little bit like Jane Austen. I mean, the big problem here, I think, is you have Jane stumbling around, lost on the moor, and the house that she goes to just happens to be the house where her long-lost cousins, the Rivers, live. So she seems to have not to know or to have forgotten that she has cousins named St. John, Diana, and Mary, when you probably remember at least the names of your cousins or the family name at some point. And also the fact that when Jane is rich and is able to marry Rochester on her own terms, Mrs. Rochester has conveniently burnt herself, which obviously, I mean, we wouldn't have the solution if that was the case.
That's great. About the wings,
Sure. No, I mean, it's, the fact, again, well, to some extent, the way in which the uncle can make contact but doesn't make contact with, and the Rivers hiding the fact that he'd written all that, is slightly difficult to believe. But it's, I mean, it's not as bad as Dickens' coincidences. Dickens has far too many coincidences. Coincidences do happen in life, but I think you're allowed one per novel. Okay, so the name game, the part you're interested in. The names in Jane Eyre are often both significant and ironic. Jane is proverbially plain. Plain Jane is a sort of typical expression. Jane's plainness make her an unusual heroine in English fiction. Of course, the vast majority of English novels have a pretty young woman as the female protagonist, and that is not the case here. And is what probably is what most goes wrong in film versions of this novel, that Jane in film versions tends to be far too pretty for the thing to actually make sense. Eyre, as the surname, comes from a real local family in Yorkshire at the time, who had a mad woman locked up in their home. So there is a real basis to this. But of course, the fact that Eyre is a homophone of air gives the idea of birds and freedom, and that sort of thing that comes up regularly in the novel. And also, ironically, Eyre is the masculine form, heiress is the feminine form, but Eyre, the idea that Jane Eyre is an heiress, is ironic during most of the novel because she is completely on her own as an orphan rather than being somebody who inherits. For us, Eyre, as it is written, probably reminds us more than anything of an eerie.
Oh, I hate it because of time lapse.
What's an eerie? Any idea? No. Eerie, pronounced the same but written differently, means phantasmal. So you're on the right track, but not in this case. An eerie is the nest, the high, high nest of an eagle or a condor or something like that. I don't know if you have a special name for that type of eagle. Eagle elk. And the spelling there would suggest that. The novel mentions a condor's eerie when describing the yell Richard Manson utters when attacked by his sister. So there is the direct reference to that. This is not Paddy Desmond Ballas on my part, but this is, there is a direct mention there. The earring could also represent Jane's high ideas, but it also represents the highest part of the house from which Bertha swoops down, like a bird of prey, and attacks her victims. Eire, of course, is a name for the Republic of Ireland, and there are some references to Ireland there. And, of course, biographically, Jane's father came from Ireland. Mrs. Reed, a reed can be an instrument of punishment. However, interestingly, Mrs. Reed prefers the psychological torture of the Red Room to corporal punishment. So, I mean, it would be perfectly normal at this time for somebody in that situation to use a reed on a child. But this is actually not the case. And the name is also ironic because the symbolic quality of a reed, of course, is flexibility. And the one thing that Mrs. Reed seems to be very not is flexible. Helen Burns, there's the idea that Helen is warm, is compassionate, and burns with religious passion. But Helen has to survive in the hostile, frigid world of Lowood by going into herself, by daydreaming, and by seeking religious solace. But this is not enough, and she burns up with fever. However, she is passive in the face of injustice and is cold in death. So we have the whole hot cold game going on again. Miss Temple, Temple suggests sanctuary. Miss Temple marries a clergyman, foreshadowing Jane's St. John option. Blanche is blanched. When we refer to blanched in English? About the only time we ever use the adjective blanched is blanched almonds. Las almendras peladas como blanquecinas, that's blanched almonds. I don't know what they actually do to them, but that's when we use blanched to mean whitened. And she, of course, is bland and passionless. Bertha means bright in Germanic languages, which could associate her with burning passion, but is also ironic since she is associated with the night and is imprisoned indoors. Bertha also echoes bird, Bertha, similar to sounds, and she is a caged bird. She eventually destroys the cage with fire. So, the river's names. St. John could refer to St. John the Apostle, who wrote the Revelation, or to St. John the Baptist, who baptized in the River Jordan. John, St. John rivers, blah, blah, blah. Rivers could refer to the pool of the current. The rivers are the mirror image of the reeds, two sisters, one brother. The male cousins are contrasted by name, John, Reed, St. John, Rivers. Diana Rivers is the Virgin Huntress. Mary Rivers is the Virgin Mother, both unmarried and latterly independent. Do Reed, Air, Burns, and Rivers represent earth, air, fire, and water? Perhaps. Does air hint at Eire, Ireland, where Charlotte's father was born and where Rochester suggests Jane should go when she leaves Thornfield? What about the place names? Gateshead. What does Gateshead imply?
Gateshead.
Yeah. But what does it imply? Gateshead is a place in Yorkshire, in the north of England, and it means El Promontorio de las Cabras, but that has nothing to do with this. There was the idea of both gates and head as the idea of it being the entrance, the beginning of the novel. It's an appropriate name for the beginning of the novel. Lowood implies a dell, a low wood, a dark low point in Jane's life. Thornfield implies a field of thorns, terrain that is difficult and or painful to cross. Moorhouse is self-explanatory. And Ferndean also implies a dell. A dean and a dell are more or less the same thing, a wooded valley. But while ferns are associated with woodland and moorland, they also suggest softness, and this is clearly the most euphonic place name in the novel. So there are games going on there as well. So, what is the Marxist interpretation of Jane Eyre? Well, the contemporaries, when this novel was published, very much saw this as a revolutionary novel, to some extent a dangerous novel, and it was associated with the revolutionary climate of 1848. That year, conservative Elizabeth Rigby wrote in the Quarterly Review, which was the Quarterly Review, the same turn of thought which fostered Chartism and rebellion is the same which has also written Jane Eyre. In 1855, Mrs. Oliphant wrote, Jane Eyre had provoked the most alarming revolution of modern times, if you can imagine. We already have the idea of somebody who is intelligent and well-educated who cannot advance themselves socially is considered a threat to the status quo. It's very much the situation of William Langland or of Horatio in the Spanish tragedy or of Bosola in The Duchess of Malfi. The clergy, above all the clergy's children, were very much in this type of position in rural society in Britain. While there was an increasing urban middle class outside the cities, what you tended to have was an upper class and a lower class, and nothing in between. Aristocracy and servants, and so governesses were an anomaly. And the children of the clergy would tend to be educated with the children of the aristocracy, but of course then had fewer financial possibilities. Jane has been an outsider from the beginning. At Gateshead, she is considered neither truly family nor servant. Fanny Price in Austen's Mansfield Park suffers under a similar set of expectations as a dependent. Jane is a figure of ambiguous class standing and consequently a source of extreme tension for the characters around her. Jane's manners, sophistication and education are those of an aristocrat. Because Victorian governesses who tutored children in etiquette as well as academics were expected to possess the culture of the aristocracy. In the aristocratic folklore, governesses were liable to both madness and seduction. Jane presumably is aware of this. Blanche describes governesses as incubi. The new industrialists, the bourgeoisie, could buy their way into the aristocracy. Jane can buy into the plutocracy, as Bertha did, incidentally. Miss Ingram's loveless pursuit of Rochester for his money can be seen to parallel Bertha's and Celine Baron's. Jane Eyre constantly, Jane Eyre the novel, not Jane Eyre the person, constantly asks, what is class? Is it money? Is it education? Is it family name? Is it some sort of weird combination of these things? This, a century earlier, wouldn't really have been a problem. But the same as it is for us today, you know, what is middle class? What is upper class? We really, people use the terms and are talking about a completely different thing. For example, the Americans, middle class is anybody who works, who's not sort of part of the lump, and they don't really even perceive of a working class, certainly the politicians, etc., etc. as a child, Jane is the same class as the Reeds in terms of blood, but not in terms of money. John calls her a dependent. She calls him a murderer, a slave trader, and a Roman emperor. Clear signs of an incipient class consciousness. She resists her captor like a rebel slave, and she is taken to the Red Room. She refuses to accept that young Master John is her master. Jane confuses Mrs. Fairfax as the owner of Thornfield. Mrs. Fairfax is, in fact, a distant relative of Rochester. Again, her class is ambiguous. Diana and Mary Rivers are also the poor daughters of upper-class parents. However, Jane's eventual gentrification can be seen as part of the Renaissance trope of blue-bloodedness. In the end, she returns to the class she rightfully belongs to. She only seems to be lower class. Yeah? The inheritance demonstrates otherwise. Yeah, I mean, the sort of weird childish class consciousness in some sense is similar to Maud Flanders, in the sense of, you know, we think of children not thinking in terms of class, but clearly in these cases they very much do. There's a bit about the psychoanalytical analysis which you can read for yourselves. Fun part, post-colonial criticism. The post-colonial argument goes, Jane Eyre and Charlotte Bronte, so Jane Eyre and through her Charlotte Bronte, are colonial fascist xenophobes who participate in and benefit from the empire. The evidence for this is that all foreigners in the novel are portrayed negatively. They are suspect and, well, foreign. Foreigners in general, unlike Britishers, cannot control their passions or lasciviousness. Jane prefers English culture and education to French education and insists on a girl being educated in an appropriately British way. Bertha Mason is treated like a caged animal because of her dark skin and passionate nature, and because she speaks Spanish. Bertha is described as discolored and savage, purple, with swelled and dark lips, and bloodshot eyes. These terms can be associated with 19th century descriptions of vampires, which reflect stereotypes both of Jews, cannibals, and simply foreigners. Okay, so that is the post-colonial argument. To which I would answer, most of the English characters Sarah Reed, John Reed, Eliza Reed, Georgina Reed, Mr. Bucklehurst and all of his family, Miss Scratchard, Blanche Ingram, her sister, Lady Ingram, and Grace Poole are all portrayed negatively in the novel. So while there may be quite a lot of foreigners who are portrayed negatively, most of the English characters are also portrayed negatively. Adele is portrayed in a not unsympathetic way, and Madame Perrault, the French teacher, is one of the nicest characters in Volume 1. Rochester seeks out actresses and prostitutes for his sexual liaison. Bronte never implies that similar women do not exist in British cities. There is never any sense that Richard Mason and Madame Perrault are not in control of their passions. British culture is more adequate for Adele, who is, after all, growing up in Britain. It's not the idea, if she was growing up in France, no doubt French education would be more appropriate, but it depends where the child is growing up.
In the future, for example, he has to be a servant.
Adele?
Yes.
You think?
She goes back and she stays there and have a future.
But she's not treated like a servant, really, is she? You think? She's, I mean. Bertha is treated like a caged animal because she is violent and dangerous. Her brother is not described according to his color. Bertha is discolored because she is permanently indoors and is usually seen in at night by candlelight. As defined in the 1760, in the dictionary of 1760, Creole referred to someone born and naturalized in the West Indies, but of European or African descent, the name having no connotation of color. It seems pretty clear from the novel that Bertha is a white colonial. She's not mulatto or whatever the term would be. Most importantly, the Masons belong to the colonial planter class who oppressed the colonial population, not to the oppressed and the colonized. They were the people whose wealth was ruined by the British abolition of slavery. So it is wrong to identify the Masons as the colonized class. They are, in fact, the colonial class. So basically, as far as I can see, the post-colonial analysis of this novel. Right. There's an interesting feminist critique of the novel. Bertha can be seen as a symbol of the trapped Victorian wife, imprisoned in domestic uselessness, driven mad because she has no outlet for her anxieties and frustrations. There is a central male, three central male figures threaten Jane's desire for equality and dignity. Mr. Brocklehurst, Edward Rochester, and St. John Rivers. All three, at some level, are misogynistic. Jane wishes to be useful and needed without being dependent, to serve on her own terms. Having a family, the Rivers, and money allows Jane to marry Rochester as someone who is emotionally and financially independent. Yet there is also a certain irony at the end of the novel. Jane needs the deus ex machina element of an uncle leaving her a fortune, which guarantees her financial independence, and her Byronic, lascivious husband is maimed, incapacitated, and partially impoverished, so he has to be dependent on her for her to be happy. If this is wish fulfillment, then is Bronte saying that the male must be gelded, must be emasculated, for there to be domestic bliss? Rochester is more responsible and conventional than he might at first appear. He houses his mad wife at home when it would be reasonable to have her institutionalized. After all, she is dangerous, and that would have been perfectly acceptable at the time. He takes in Adele when he has no responsibility for her. She's not, Adele is not his daughter, and yet he takes charge of her. And we could see the novel as a description of patriarchy. Bronte analyzes the workings of patriarchy in that she presents us with a series of households administered and apparently controlled by women, but actually ruled by men. Gateshead is administered by Mrs. Reed for despotic John Reed. Lowood is administered by Miss Temple for tyrannical Brocklehurst. Thornfield is administered by Mrs. Fairfax for Rochester. Morehouse is administered by Diana and Mary for St. John. Equality only comes when Rochester abdicates power at Ferndean and ends up sharing it with Joan. Rather pessimistically, this occurs outside or on the very margins of society. More or less. Okay, any questions? I'm going to finish on time to make Adriana happy. So, I will post those notes tonight. Next week, you have a sort of holiday in that we will be talking about Victorian women in general. But, of course, you are... it would be a good idea if you could read The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for the following week. I can't remember if that's optional. Is it optional? It's right. But it's quite interesting. But it's up to you. It's not very long either. But depending on how much work you have, you can either read that or not. But we will talk about that the following week. There is, of course, a huge